We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. Back in the 1970s, many of the top earthquake researchers said that they thought that reliable earthquake prediction was just around the corner. Yet today, despite the fact that there have been rapid advances in earthquake science, seismologists still cannot predict when, precisely when and where, the next major quake will strike. This morning in this hour of Focus 580, we will spend some time looking into the tumultuous science of earthquake prediction as we talk with Susan Huff. She is a seismologist with the Southern California Earthquake Center. She's also a fellow of the American Geophysical Union and is the author of a newly published book, and I have stolen there the subtitle of her book, Tumultuous Science of Earthquake Prediction. The title of her book is Predicting the Unpredictable, and it is published by the Princeton University Press it's a book that's intended for a general audience, too. So if you're interested in the whole business of earthquakes, you should take a look at it. It talks a little bit about the science of earthquakes, what we know about why earthquakes occur, things that people have tried to do to predict them, and things that maybe have worked a little bit and things that maybe have not worked at all. And certainly, as we talk this morning, questions from people who are listening will be welcome. Now, the only thing we ask of people who are asking questions is that people just try to be brief. That way we can move things along, get in as many callers as possible. But certainly questions are welcome. And the numbers here for local folks, the number is 333-9455. So that's if you're in Champaign, Urbana. If it would be a long-distance call, we have a toll-free line for you. That's 800-222-9455. And now we're taking questions by email. So you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And it'll really help us if you can keep those questions brief. In any case, it helps to keep them brief. Just that way we can get as many people in as possible. And joining us this morning by telephone, Dr. Susan Huff. Dr. Huff, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
We're going to explore this in some depth, and I guess I want to make sure that I understand something right off, because here very early in the book, you write, arguably the biggest unanswered question in earthquake science is this: what if anything happens in the earth that sets a big earthquake in motion? And then you go on to talk about the fact that, well, scientists, earthquakes, scientists, seismologists aren't exactly sure what that is. Now, and I guess when I first read that, the question in my mind was, well, does that really mean that you don't know what causes earthquakes? Am I misreading that?
Okay, yes and no. We do understand why earthquakes happen. We have plate tectonics, these big pieces of the crust that are moving slowly, and they get locked up, and eventually they have to break. So in a sense, we understand the engine that drives earthquakes. It's kind of the transmission that we don't understand. That, you know, what is it that causes an earthquake to be at 2:30 in the morning on Saturday? What happens to be that last straw? And that's what we don't know.
And that's, I suppose, that is what you would need to know if you were going to do the kind of prediction that people would, that would be the ideal, which would be to say, at this spot, on this day, at this time, there's going to be an earthquake.
Right, or at least if we understand that answer, we know if earthquakes are predictable. The answer may be no, that nothing special happens before a big earthquake, in which case prediction is impossible. But if something does happen, then that something is going to have some trace that we can hope to find.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that does lead to the question, and I guess some people have asked this question, is there really a point to earthquake science that in the sense that is there a point to doing all of this work if we think that there's a possibility that really at the end of the day, after having invested a lot of time and work on the part of scientists, that the answer you come up with is, well, actually, we don't. There is no answer, and it's not for lack of trying. It's just that it's not an answerable kind of question.
Okay, yeah, what good are seismologists, you know?
Well, I don't really want to put it quite like that.
Well, no, it's the whole field doesn't stand or fall on earthquake prediction. And prediction, we may see it as the holy grail, and the public may really want it to take away that horrible aspect of unpredictability. But the real name of the game is making sure our structures and our infrastructure can withstand the shaking that happens. Because even if you predict an earthquake, it's still going to be a matter of the buildings withstanding it. And in that direction, we've made huge progress. Also, the business of forecasting, evaluating the expected long-term rate of earthquakes, and how big, how many in places like California or the eastern U.S., and that tells us where to focus our efforts.
That just let me sort of go down a side road here and talk just for a second about earthquake preparedness, simply because I know that I have had some conversations with people here in this area,
mm-hmm.
And here we are in a seismic zone, the New Madrid seismic zone, and we do know that here in our area on that zone, in that zone, in the not too distant past, there has been a big quake, and scientists say, "Look, the odds are that one of these days we're going to have another one," and it has gotten publicity from time to time. The last time it really got big publicity was when someone made a prediction, which turned out not to be the case. But somebody made a prediction, got a lot of attention, got people sort of talking about it and thinking about it. But after that kind of died down, we went on to think about other things, and I know that there are people here in this area who are very worried that we are nowhere near being prepared for such a thing should it happen. And I think that they would say, I can't tell you when it's going to happen, but it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's New Madrid is actually one of my research interests, and that's a whole different interview and a whole different story. There's been a huge debate about how big the earthquakes were in 1811, 1812, and how often we can expect them to recur. And there are people saying, well, they're never going to happen again, and there are people saying they're going to happen every few hundred years, which is pretty frequent. So there's a lot of thing. Our understanding of our ability to forecast earthquakes is a lot worse in the mid-continent than it is in an active place. But yeah, the concern is that preparedness has really lagged behind California. And if you look at what happened in 1811, 1812, it actually wasn't, I think, the regional catastrophe that people sometimes think. In St. Louis, a few brick buildings were cracked, essentially. And in Louisville, a few chimneys were knocked down. But there's other worrisome issues like the bridges crossing the Mississippi and other regions. We know the river valleys are going to shake really hard. We know that critical structures aren't built to the same kind of codes that we have here in California. So, you have huge uncertainties about precise forecasts, but clearly earthquakes like that have happened and they can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to deal with that.
So then if you're looking at a particular place that you know has been marked in the past by seismic activity, that you can't say something like the longer the elapsed time between the last big activity and whatever the next one is, the longer that takes, the probability that you will have another one goes up. Is that, do those two things actually not correlate?
Yeah, it's actually a good question and a much trickier question than it seems like, because the plates move and stress builds up and then stress gets released, and that sort of implies a cycle with a certain time scale. And so you'd think that, yeah, the longer it's been since the last earthquake, the closer the next one is. It's just in even seismologists, we tend to have that impression. The problem is that earthquakes, they don't happen like clockwork, and they seem to cluster in time. So I use the analogy of traffic on a freeway, that you just, if cars are sort of moving, but sometimes they bunch up. If you've just seen a car go by, it may mean that you're in a little bunch of cars and the next car is going to happen quickly. Mm-hmm. If a car hasn't gone by for a while, it tells you that, well, you're in the middle of a long gap and maybe it's going to be even longer. So I think there is some reality to the idea of an earthquake cycle. In California, big earthquakes happen on the San Andreas every, you know, maybe 200 years. The problem is the variability is so big that on human timescales, it's hard to make precise statements. If an earthquake is, you know, we think it's overdue, it may not happen for 50 or 80 years.
Let me quickly introduce our guest for anyone who's just tuned in. Susan Huff is a seismologist with the Southern California Earthquake Center. She's also a fellow of the American Geophysical Union. She's written books that include Richter Scale, Measure of an Earthquake, Measure of a Man, and Earthshaking Science, What We Know and Don't Know About Earthquakes. And her most recent book is Predicting the Unpredictable, The Tumultuous Science of Earthquake Prediction. It's published by the Princeton University Press. In fact, I think all of your books are published by Princeton. Is that right?
There are two others that weren't.
Oh, okay.
But the best ones are probably.
The ones that I mentioned, they're all Princeton University Press. So if folks listening would like to read more about earthquake science, they should look for those books. And questions are welcome. We have someone here ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Geneva on our toll-free line, on line four. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, right down my alley. My mom lives right on the San Andreas Fault there in Palmdale. So, not a good place. I grew up out there, so I know exactly what you're talking about. There's people out here who seem to think it's that California is going to fall in the ocean, and plate tectonics, you got to tell people that, no, it's going north-south instead of you know, because that's the big joke of the land anymore. Oh, we're going to have beachfront property and all that kind of stuff. But I grew up out there. I basically worked for the Forest Service for 20-plus years. I'm retired from there now. But I used to work at the Angeles, and they used to have those survey. And I don't know if they still do, but they used to have the laser stations up there where they were keeping track of how much it's moved. And the San Andreas Fault moves a lot. I mean, people don't understand. But I think the last time I talked to somebody up there, they said it moved like a couple inches the last couple of years or something. And there's a lot of activity going on, like up towards Mammoth Mountain and all that with the volcanoes. You know, I think that's, you know, you should explain, the volcanic activity, how that, in, you know, hooks up with, but
how that fits in, you mean?
Yeah, how that fits in, and also the, you know, like Hawaii, same thing. You know, I was over there last year, and they were having earthquakes all the time, and that thing was moving every direction. So, you know, the plate tectonic stuff is really interesting. I should have went back into that, but the geology type stuff, especially in California, that place is just full of zones, earthquake zones.
Yeah, I actually grew up in Champaign. So.
Did you really? I didn't know that. Wow.
Gary Busey Elementary School.
Hey. All right.
So let's see. Yeah, volcanoes are sort of a separate story in some ways. And they volcanoes, the eruptions actually are fairly predictable because when you build towards an eruption like we had at Mount St. Helens or Pinatubo, the earth starts to rumble and we see this characteristic signature. And we have made impressive advances in predicting eruptions and saving lives. And volcanoes seem to be different from earthquakes in that respect. How they fit in with earthquakes is sort of an interesting separate story, and they're related, obviously. It all has to do with plate tectonics. So I talk about that in my first book, but it's not the focus of the prediction book.
Thank you very much, by the way. Yeah, we should trade jobs. I want to get the heck out of Dodge. It's too cold here.
All right. Well,
but we have earthquakes, so it's, you know, trade-off.
Other questions, again, welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. Toll free. 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Is it correct to say that California, in terms of how well mapped its various faults in its geology is one of the best, at least in terms of that, is one of the best mapped places anyplace?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement, and we think we found all the active faults. You know, we've been surprised even fairly recently by earthquakes that, you know, faults that sort of illuminated themselves by having big earthquakes. But, yeah, we have a much better handle on things here. And the saying in the mid-continent is you have earthquakes without faults and faults without earthquakes. It's a very enigmatic situation about where the earthquakes are happening and why. In New Madrid, we have identified active faults. And in Oklahoma, there's an active fault that's, you know, really impressive. You can put your hand on it. But for the most part, it's very enigmatic.
Well, do you explain the fact that California is so well mapped? Do you explain that because there is a lot to map and it is seismically active, or does it have something to do with the fact that that's where that's also kind of where modern American earthquake science starts?
Well, those are related. As the caller said, that, you know, the plates are moving pretty quickly out here. It's a couple inches per year. So with GPS instruments, we can watch the plates move, and it's really pretty cool when you think about it. Everything looks very, you know, unchanging when you look at the landscape. But from a plate tectonics point of view, it's all in motion, and we can map that out. And so you have a lot of data to work with, and you have historic earthquakes, because the big ones like 1906 happen frequently enough that you've seen them just in historic times, and then you can dig into the geology and see the prehistoric earthquakes going back thousands of years. We also have the main fault is on land, so you can dig into it. It's sort of a laboratory for earthquake science. Turkey's the same way. Other places like Japan or Alaska, the major faults are offshore and underwater. So they're a little harder to investigate.
All right, let's take another call here. This is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello there.
Yeah.
What is the tense of our central earthquake zone putting the Mississippi River back past Poplar Bluff, that had been at one time in Missouri? And then is there any thought that with rising sea levels and what have you, with an earthquake, that the Great Sea Basin, which is our states of Arizona, New Mexico, et cetera, might fill up again?
Okay, I'm not sure I heard the first question. Are you asking about the account that the Mississippi River ran backwards?
There was a time when the Mississippi River ran past Poplar Bluff, Missouri.
Okay, and the course changed, you're asking?
Yeah.
I actually don't know about that. It may have just been river meandering from other processes. The earthquakes in 1811 and 12 and early earthquakes did change the course, but river courses change for other reasons, and I'm actually not familiar with the situation you're asking about. In terms of sea levels, it is. There are low-lying areas that are going to be threatened, obviously, and the deltas, you know, the New Orleans are kind of the canary in the coal mine. Those places are going to start to see the flooding first. The southernmost California, the Gulf of California, is kind of, in general, it's Baja California is going to continue to peel away from the mainland over time, over millions of years. And so the sea level rise is going to hasten some of the inundation. I think in terms of flooding, you know, Phoenix or something, that's not something we're going to see.
Okay. Again, questions are welcome. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Susan Huff. She is a seismologist with the Southern California Earthquake Center and is author of the book Predicting the Unpredictable. The subtitle is The Tumultuous Science of Earthquake Prediction. That's published by the Princeton University Press. Just for a second, going back to this period in the 1920s, when I think in a lot of ways modern earthquake science was getting going here in the United States, and there was this big effort to look at California and to look at to try to map out the various faults. Was this something, though, that the scientists who were working on it were having a hard time making the argument that it was actually something important to do? I mean, was there actually support for spending money to do this?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting that 1906 happened, and even before 1906, geologists were getting had an understanding that earthquakes were fairly common in the West, and that's why you started to see the growth of geology departments in places like Berkeley and Stanford early on, because you know an earthquake scientist wants to be where the action is. So you know, earthquakes had happened in the Bay Area in 1868, a big one, and the scientific community had started to develop, and then 1906 happened, and it was clear that earthquakes were a big issue in the San Francisco Bay Area. In Los Angeles, where the growth started a little bit later, there was a heated debate about whether earthquakes were a problem down here, and as there started to be business interests, they started to want to downplay the risk, and you know, the oil companies came in and they started to map out the faults. You can see faults if you with a trained eye; they're all over the place down here. But there were people arguing that they were old faults, they were relics of a past time, they were harmless. And then in the midst of that, we had sort of the first of the big prediction, you know, circuses in the media when a well-respected geologist came out with essentially a prediction that a big earthquake was very likely. And so what actually, the prediction was discredited, and it turned out to be based on essentially faulty data, early data with a lot of uncertainties. But then the 33 Long Beach earthquake happened, and that sort of settled that.
It's really interesting. Well, I suppose it's also kind of frustrating for people in the field, I'm sure, that people make predictions and that gets attention, and it particularly gets attention if it turns out that it was correct. For example, I think the last year there was a scientist in Italy that got a lot of attention because this was one of the people who's in the camp that says radon, emissions of radon can be a good predictor in advance of an earthquake. And that is apparently that's one of the things that some people have said, well, maybe that would be one of your early warning signs. So he said, there's going to be a quake here at this time. And it turns out that he was off by a few days. But in fact, the quake occurred. So suddenly everybody thought, well, this guy's got something. And he said, now, see, I told you so. And so what happens is if someone, no matter what method they're using, if someone makes a prediction and then there's a quake, that's going to get a lot of attention. Then I suppose the other side of that is, you know, who knows how many people over how long have made predictions that don't turn out. Well, we don't catalog those. But if somebody says there's going to be an earthquake and there is, well, that is going to get a lot of attention.
Yeah, the thing is that raises a couple of interesting issues, the L'Aquila case. But, you know, one of the interesting things, if you look back over time, people make a whole lot of predictions. And people in earthquake science on the fringes, people who are you know just outside the field entirely, and the sort of surprising thing is how few of them come true. Because a lot of you know earthquakes happen by random chance, and if people are making predictions all over the place, then you'd expect some of them to come true. And it's almost like the Earth has this perversity of shutting off the earthquakes when people make predictions. So the thing is, yeah, if people are out there making a lot of predictions, not any individual, but just collectively, they're going to be hits. They've been few and far between. But the thing is about the whole radon, there's an interesting point that even scientists miss. There's a question of precursors, of what happens before an earthquake. And it's possible that, well, we know some big earthquakes have foreshocks. So some big earthquakes may well have precursors. You know, in L'Aquila, you had little earthquakes. Maybe the faults were moving around. Maybe there was radon release as a result of that. So the radon signal may have been related to the large earthquake. The problem is you can't make for prediction, you need reliable precursors. You need something that happens reliably before large earthquakes and only before large earthquakes. And people looked carefully at radon in the 70s and were starting in California. They saw anomalies and they came out with statements that you were going to have big earthquakes. And then the next big earthquake was someplace entirely different. Mm-hmm. So any one precursor might be real, and it might be interesting to study, but that doesn't mean that you can make predictions based on these signals.
I guess that I wondered, you know, does that mean that in your one might develop an approach that would say, here maybe we can point to maybe five different things that may be an indicator. The more of those things we see, the more confident that we are that there will be a quake, or at least we would say we would assign a certain level of confidence to it based on what's there, so that we would never get to the point where we would say, I can tell you at this spot it's going to happen and when. But I could say, you know, I could draw on the map, I could draw a box, and I could say within this box there is a, I don't know, 50% chance or 70% chance within a certain window. And I'm sure people won't like that because it'll be too vague. And yet I wonder if that's about as good as we could get.
It's an interesting idea, and I don't think people have tended to think in those terms of looking for, well, I take it back. There are some efforts to look for kind of an aggregation of precursors. The prediction of the Haicheng earthquake in China in the mid-70s was, it's an interesting story because it wasn't quite an official, high-level, sanctioned prediction. It was more a grassroots awareness that something was likely. And what happened in that case was there was this buildup over time. There were moderate earthquakes, and then over the next few months, there was earthquake activity on and off. There were these sort of curious reports of animal behavior that may have been related to the foreshocks. There were some other anomalies. It's not clear how reliable they were. But there was kind of a preponderance of evidence that something was brewing somehow, and most notably the foreshocks. And then right before the main shock, there was a very strong burst of foreshocks that people were feeling, and they just got, you know, worried. It's sort of a gut-level concern, and people evacuated homes, and lives were saved as a result. But you know, again, the problem is that you go to other earthquakes, and in China in the next year, there was an even bigger earthquake that didn't seem to have any sort of launch sequence that anybody could find, or certainly not identify beforehand. So it may be that the big earthquakes just start in different ways. Maybe if we could, you know, figure out the launch sequence that some of them have, that would be better than nothing.
Well, we have some other callers here. Let's talk next with someone in Morris, line 4. Hello.
I was wondering if there was any correlation between glaciers forming and melting over a long period of time.
That's interesting. And earthquakes, you mean?
Yes.
Okay, the best theory, I think, to explain why you've had New Madrid earthquakes, and let me back up. In New Madrid, we had the earthquakes in 1811, 1812, but then there's good geologic evidence that you had earthquakes in 1450 AD and 900 AD. And you know that earthquakes haven't been happening in New Madrid for millions of years, because otherwise you'd build mountains there and you don't have mountains. And so, you know, there's been a cluster over the last 1,000 to few thousand years in what's going on, and I think by far the best explanation is that you have the ice sheets over a lot of North America until 10,000 years ago. And they melted, and the crust rebounds, just like a couch rebounds if you put your hand on it and take it away. And the ice didn't get down as far as New Madrid, but that's within the zone that's going to be flexing back upwards. So that does, it gives you a source of stress that can drive earthquakes. And also, if you've heard this debate that, well, New Madrid is shut off, there's no more strain there. If you look, people have modeled the process of rebound, and they crank up a computer model and put on the ice sheets. And those models predict that the process of rebound is going to continue for a few thousand years. So the prediction is that the sequences aren't going to shut off anytime soon.
On a smaller scale, is there any connection between building dams like the large one over in China and earthquakes?
These are great questions. There's clearly a connection of impounding large reservoirs can trigger earthquakes. And there was an earthquake in India, the Koyna earthquake in the 60s, that actually killed a lot of people that was pretty clearly linked to the impounding of a large dam. It, people, in the case like China, it's a concern. It's possible. The problem is, in an active area, it's hard to prove cause and effect. And so, how do you show that this earthquake, which, you know, might have happened anyway according to what we know from geology, how do you show that that was associated with something that people did? And that's tough.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. And let's see, we'll go back again to the telephone and take our next caller. And I think this is somebody on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning to you all. Now, this sounds like a dangerous concept, but I'm going to suggest it. We know that earthquakes are caused when there's friction and something stops these two plates or several plates, whatever it may be, from moving. And there's places right there in Southern California we know that their system seems to be locked. Now, has anybody ever thought about maybe pumping a little grease into the situation and solving it before it gets too bad?
There actually has been a semi-serious suggestion from a serious scientist that, well, stress is building not just on faults but regionally, so why don't you try to detonate an earthquake in a relatively harmless area and release the stress that way. I think, you know, trying to do anything on a fault there where the action is at least several miles down, and we have a very hard time drilling that far down. So the practicalities are tough. But I think, you know, most scientists, you wouldn't want to go there because you try to think that we could somehow monkey with the system and get it, the outcome, to be something useful and beneficial. You know, I think most scientists would be just unwilling to think in those terms. And once you start earthquakes, you know, processes are very complicated. Earthquakes can grow in different directions. They can link up with other faults. So I don't think that's something we're going to be ever trying.
Thank you very much.
All right. And to another caller here. This is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask a question related to damage, and I'm wondering if the speaker could talk about a scenario for Los Angeles so that the general public here could get a feeling for the possible damage. And I'm thinking the size. So would it be a strip along a fault, maybe a quarter mile on each side of the fault that would get damaged, or would it be a mile? And so something on a spatial dimension. And then perhaps related to some landmarks, so the famous theater in Hollywood or Mount Sinai Medical Center or the art buildings in downtown Los Angeles, would they be damaged and would they all be damaged in the same earthquake? And then last, the fire. San Francisco, you had the fire. Would we have that in Los Angeles? Thank you. I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, gosh. Okay, there's a couple. We talk about the big one. There's a couple of big earthquakes that would be very scary for Los Angeles. One is a big earthquake on the southern San Andreas, like we last had in 1857. The San Andreas doesn't come right through Los Angeles. It comes within tens of miles. But the other scary earthquake is that we have these faults that we have within the L.A. Basin. There's at least a half dozen of them that most scientists think could produce a 7.5 earthquake, maybe even bigger. And that would be a bad scenario because the strongest shaking would be right where the people are living. You know, in terms of exactly what's going to happen, especially for a San Andreas earthquake, it's tricky because we don't have recorded data for an earthquake like that. So there's people do use computer models to predict it, but there's really quite big uncertainty. So some results say, well, the tall buildings could get knocked down. But you know, there's just a lot of uncertainties. Just in general terms, we had the Northridge earthquake in 1994 that people may remember. The damage was concentrated in the San Fernando area. A 7.5 would be like 20 Northridge earthquakes laid end to end. So instead of a worst damage zone of about 10 miles, you're talking about a worst damage zone of 100 or 200 miles. And that's scary. And that's a great big swath of the L.A. Basin. And so you would expect to see a lot of damage. Anyone's structure, it's hard to say. There's been a lot of work done retrofitting the freeways since Northridge, and they may be in pretty good shape, we hope. Let's see, in terms of fires, that's also scary because you can sort of do predictions based on past earthquakes, and a big earthquake is going to start hundreds or thousands of separate ignitions from private homes, from gas lines, from candles, from stoves, and the fire departments are not going to be able to respond to all of those. So there's sort of a worst-case scenario where you have a big earthquake when things are really hot and dry out here, and the conflagration could be worse than the earthquake.
All right. We are into about our last 15 minutes of this hour of Focus 580, and I should introduce again the guest, Susan Huff. She's a seismologist with the Southern California Earthquake Center. She's also a fellow of the American Geophysical Union. She's authored a number of books having to do with earthquakes. She's also written for articles that appeared in a number of publications, L.A. Times and others. And her most recent book is titled Predicting the Unpredictable, The Tumultuous Science of Earthquake Prediction, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little bit involute, but I'll try and be clear. I wanted to ask you if you've been following any of the scientific discourse. There was an international conference in London about climate disruption and deglaciation, and it looks like climate change is the wrong name for what's going on. We're having a big freeze down here, but the weight of ice and snow should be quite apparent to everybody here. So I just wondered if you'd heard anything about that, and there is an argument being made that even in a small regional area, deglaciation has affected the fault lines and caused some local quakes, and these people are concerned apparently that if there's a massive deglaciation of Himalayas and Kilimanjaro, other places around the world, too numerous to mention, that it could actually affect the fault line and be another unintended, unexpected consequence of global climate disruption. Are you following that at all, or does that just sound like it's from Neptune or something?
Yeah, no, it's not from Neptune, and I'm not a climate scientist, but as I followed it, the term disruption is a good term, that things are warming, but we're also destabilizing the climate, so we're going to get more extreme events. Some places, like London, are warmed by the jet stream, and they may get a lot colder as
Gulf stream, yeah.
The global changes. So yeah, we are. We're seeing, just some bizarre weather. In terms of the ice and snow on a small scale, I'm familiar with the work that ties the weather in the Himalayan range with earthquakes. There's been some other suggestions of a similar effect. It's not a huge effect that we've seen so far, and I haven't seen any predictions that we're going to melt the glaciers and get earthquakes starting, anytime soon. It's what we have in New Madrid is playing out over thousands of years. And
yeah, there's not a lot of glaciation that would affect that area, I guess, unless the Rockies were.
Well, this would have been the end of the last ice age, which happened naturally, and so that is still affecting the central U.S. like I talked about.
It's so far is the operative word there. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. On to another caller. This is Champaign Line 2. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
We here, in central Illinois have a different situation from California. If we were to have a severe earthquake here, at this time of year, when we may have several days in a row when it's 0 degrees, on top of the structural damage and perhaps the fires, there's the question of the viability of the utilities. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you are able to say about the likelihood that we would lose electricity, gas, and water?
Boy, you know, that's a concern out here also. It's a big concern. Los Angeles, we've got faults, you know, a lot of the lifelines cross the major fault. So it is something that we worry about here also.
But you won't freeze out there.
But people like Palm Springs, it can be 110 for days on end, so there's real concern. You've got a population of senior citizens, mm-hmm. and, you know, if they lose power, if they lose water, it could be a serious situation. And so you obviously have similar but different concerns. And there is forecasting is more difficult where earthquakes are uncommon. The next big earthquake east of the Rockies may pop up someplace that nobody's even thinking about right now. It could be in Arkansas, it could be in Illinois or Boston. You know, it's just earthquakes happen so infrequently, it's more like kind of darts at a dartboard. And so if the dart hits in the wrong place, then you've got a region that's not prepared. So, yeah, there's work that can be done to strengthen utilities and pipelines, and I'm actually not sure where things stand with that in the central U.S. I would suspect they've lagged behind what's been done in California.
Okay, but is it the experience that has been accumulated with relatively large quakes? Does it typically take out the gas and water?
The power tends to come down pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, the gas lines can be disrupted. Depends on how the water gets to a region, but you can have just disruption of wires, of pipes, of you name it, when the ground shakes really hard.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, other questions, certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. How possible is it if you have a known fault, to place sensors along the fault that would detect motion so that it would give you maybe a little bit of advance notice? I mean, obviously, that wouldn't tell you that an earthquake was going to happen in 2 weeks, but I suppose some people would say any kind of notice would be helpful. So in terms of an early warning system, is such a thing feasible?
Right, yeah, that's what we call early warning, and that is feasible because you're relying on the fact that an electromagnetic signal that you could send over, you know, however, will travel a lot faster than the fastest P wave. It's the difference between lightning and thunder, essentially. And so that difference is enough to buy you a few seconds, a few tens of seconds, of heads up that a big earthquake has started, the shaking's on the way. And the Japanese have a system for the bullet train. In Mexico City, they had sort of a very rudimentary alarm system for Mexico City. And people are working on it in California, then exploring the ins and outs. It's complicated in California because you have faults right where the people are. So if an earthquake happens too close, it's going to be the flash boom with no warning in between. So you need to have the earthquake starting further away. But people are working on it, and we may start to see prototype systems. I would like to see more done in the central U.S. because what happens there is you have an earthquake and the waves travel much more efficiently than they do in California. So that's why a big earthquake all the way down in Missouri will impact St. Louis, Louisville. But it's an earthquake at a considerable distance, so there's an opportunity to buy yourself, you know, significant time if you have reliable early warning.
How is it difficult once a quake has occurred, is it difficult to pinpoint the location? That is, I guess the word I think of is epicenter, which in my mind that means that that's the point, that's the central point. Is it actually difficult to point to where that point is once a quake has occurred?
With modern instruments, the trickier part is to figure out very fast that it's going to be a big earthquake. Because a big earthquake like 1906 is going to be, the fault's going to be moving for maybe 2 minutes. So you can't wait 2 minutes to figure out that it's a big earthquake, because then the warning opportunity is gone. You have to look at the first few seconds of shaking and know that this is going to be a 7 and not a 4. And that turns out to be one of the tricky problems, because some earthquakes sort of start gradually. You know, so looking at those first few wiggles and reliably saying, knowing that it's going to be big, is the big problem that we have. And if you don't do that right, what you end up with is false alarms, and that's not going to be a viable system.
We talked a little bit earlier about some of the things that some people have suggested might be predictors of quakes. One is radon emissions. That's one. Some people think, well, maybe if you suddenly start to see that, or you can detect that, that might tell you something. Another thing that we touched on is the foreshock. That is a smaller earthquake, or maybe a series of smaller earthquakes that precede a really big one. And the only problem with that is that sometimes that works, but then sometimes there are really big earthquakes where there were no foreshocks. So, you know, that might tell you something sometime, but not all the time. There are a number of other things. We talked about the fact that some people say, well, if you watch animals, their behavior, they're somehow tuned in to something that we're not, and that might tell you something. There are, in fact, though, some other things that some people have suggested might be predictors. Now, I've ticked off a couple of the things that are on the list. Are there some other things that are particularly interesting?
Yeah, there are a number of them, and I try to go through the important ones in the book. The bigger problem with foreshocks, which you mentioned, isn't that some earthquakes don't have foreshocks. The problem is you have a magnitude 4 earthquake, and you have to say, what's the probability that this is a foreshock? And there's nothing about that magnitude 4 that looks any different from any other magnitude 4 that we've been able to tell. So you can't make a prediction every time you have a magnitude 4. So that's the issue there. In terms of other proposed precursors, there's a large realm of electromagnetic precursors, that somehow there are processes in the Earth that are generating electromagnetic signals that are detectable. And it's an interesting idea, and people are doing serious work along those lines. Geochemical changes in groundwater, for example. There was an observation of, I think it was a beer brewery in Japan, that noticed a change in the chemistry of water prior to the Kobe earthquake. And that's sort of like radon. Are faults moving, or gases being released? The idea of strain, that the Earth, you know, we know that strain, or, you know, warping of the crust happens sort of over a long term. But there's this a long-standing idea that, well, that ramps up, that the Earth all of a sudden starts to warp more abruptly before earthquakes. And, you know, that was the Palmdale Bulge back in the 70s, and there have been other observations that maybe that's going on. And the scientists have looked very carefully at that. And none of them, apart from these sort of isolated observations and intriguing individual observations, none of those have really held up.
I have someone emailed a question, and I want to try and get this in because I think the questions are interesting. I just sort of mentioned in passing the fact that some people think that you can look at animals and their behavior, and that can tell you something. Is there any really significant research going on actually doing that, you know, having some animals and just putting them in a place where activity might be likely and just watching what they do?
There there were a couple of studies back in the 70s when the idea was being talked about more. And, you know, things like putting a bunch of cockroaches near the fault and trying to monitor their activity or looking at electric eels. They're tough experiments to design, and none of them that were done ever panned out. One person looked at lost pet ads, reasoning that, well, animals get unsettled, maybe they tend to run away from home, and there was no correlation between the ads and the frequency of ads and earthquakes. There is a correlation between storms and earthquakes. Mm-hmm. Storms and lost pet ads. That storms happen in animals.
Oh, sure. They get upset and they run away. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, there again, you know, you just have this huge body of anecdotal stories. The problem is, you know, if you have a cat, you know that cat acts bizarre for no apparent reason sometimes because that's what cats do. So if an earthquake happens any time, some percentage of cats is going to have been acting bizarre for no apparent reason the day before. And that's what we struggle against to sort of demonstrate anything significant.
Yeah, just because two things happen to occur close in time doesn't necessarily mean that they're connected.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Anything, just real quick, anything really interesting new in the way of technology that we use to try to get an idea about what's going on beneath the surface, you know, where we can't see?
There is sort of a whole realm of developments looking at what we call non-volcanic tremor. And it's sort of a chatter that happens on some faults, mostly subduction zones like Alaska, Japan, the Pacific Northwest. And you have a locked part of the fault and then a deeper part of the fault. And it turns out that there's this chatter along different parts of the fault and below where it's lit. This is complicated, so I can't really explain it. But, you know, we are starting to get a handle on what's going on below some locked faults. And so there's a possibility that, you know, things going on below a locked fault may be part of what nudges the fault to break. So there's some very intriguing early results. The problem is we're waiting to get enough data.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop. For people who'd like to read more on the subject, look for the book Predicting the Unpredictable, The Tumultuous Science of Earthquake Predictions, published by the Princeton University Press by our guest, Susan Huff. She's a seismologist with the Southern California Earthquake Center. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.